ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Ian Mosby's talk, Nutrition Research and Human Experimentation at the Shubenacadie Indian Residential School in Historical Context. It was an invited lecture at Acadie University and the Millbrook First Nation on September 18, 2013. You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
This is an amazing turnout, unexpected, and hopefully I can live up to the expectations of people sitting in the rows. I don't know if that's possible, but I just want to, you know, without going on too long about, well, thank you. So I want to echo what everyone has said beforehand, and thank everyone for their hard work in putting this on. I want to thank Tom especially for really being the driving force behind this, but Don, Jeanette, Jean, Ramona, Cynthia, and I especially, you know, from the bottom of my heart, want to thank Mi'kmaq elders that I spoke with today. You know, I'll never forget this experience. This was, you know, the highlight of my career, without a doubt. And, you know, as Don was saying, it was a powerful room, the things that were said. And I really want to thank the Indigenous Student Society of Acadia. The students I met today, you know, are fantastic. You know, Acadia is lucky to have them. And so, so I think before I really begin and get into, you know, the talking about the experiments that I'm going to be looking at today, I just want to start by saying that how privileged I feel, how privileged that I've been to be given this opportunity to tell this particular story. About the devastating impact of Canada's colonial policies during the 1940s and 1950s, in the hopes that it will contribute in some way to achieving real truth and reconciliation in Canada. When I first published the article that this talk is going to be based upon, I really didn't expect the kind of public response that it received. Although I knew the story was extremely important, and I very much wanted to communicate this terrible chapter in the history of Canadian colonialism outside of the sometimes impenetrable walls of the Ivory Tower, I didn't expect it to be front page news across the country for as long as it was. In my hometown, or in the town I currently live in, the Toronto Star, the biggest newspaper, ran this story on the front page for 3 days in a row and continued to publish articles about it for 2 weeks afterwards. And I was interviewed by literally dozens of news outlets, ranging from the scientific journal Nature to the New York Times to small Indigenous community newspapers and radio stations in BC, the Northwest Territories, and Ontario. Canadians, in other words, were taking this story seriously in a way that I had only hoped that they would. And, you know, it seemed at the time that real pressure was being put on the federal government to right this historical wrong. But the story that I told in my paper and the story that I'm going to be telling today is only a partial one. There are more documents out there beyond the reach of a single historian like myself. And they contain the full story of what precisely was done by scientists and bureaucrats in residential schools and First Nations across the country in the name of scientific research. And while I'm going to do my best in the coming years to find out the whole story, find out exactly what was going on, it's also up to the federal government to not only release all of the documents related to these and other scientific experiments conducted on Indigenous peoples without their knowledge or consent, but also to take genuine steps towards righting this specific historical wrong. The survivors of these experiments deserve more and are entitled to more. So it's my hope that after this talk, we can perhaps discuss what can be done by all of us to seek justice for the survivors of these experiments and to make sure that it will never happen again to future generations. And so with that preface out of the way, I want to begin this talk by going back to April 1952, when Dr. Lionel Bradley Pett, one of Canada's leading nutrition experts and the director of the Nutrition Division of the Canadian Department of Health and Welfare, stood up before the American Institute of Nutrition in New York City to present a paper entitled The Development of Anemia on Newfoundland Enriched Flour. Pett began his presentation by outlining the details of a 5-year study which had examined the effects of feeding white flour, fortified with added thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, and ground bone meal, to students at an unnamed boarding school in comparison with students at a similarly unnamed control school. The results, Pett informed the audience, were rather disappointing. Blood tests showed that the children at the experimental school quickly began to develop iron deficiency anemia for the duration of the study. While at the control school, hemoglobin levels actually saw some improvement. The conclusion, according to Pett, was not simply that the experimental fortified flour mixture offered no benefits to students, and it may in fact have caused the anemia observed. For Pett, the much more important conclusion was that given the unexpected results of the study, more studies like this one were clearly necessary if scientists and policymakers alike were to really understand the effects of adding chemical additives like synthetic vitamins to our food supply. As Pett explained to the audience, the actual proof of whether or not fortified foods were truly safe or beneficial required, quote, tedious physiological studies. Unfortunately, he argued, such studies are often omitted or confined to certain animal experiments rather than to humans. He concluded, therefore, by suggesting that, quote, the benefits or hazards of adding chemicals to foods cannot, in the present state of knowledge, be judged on theoretical grounds or on limited animal experimentation, but need physiological testing on humans. Of course, what Pett neglected to mention to his New York audience was that his experiments on the Aboriginal students of St. Mary's and St. Paul's Indian residential schools was largely made possible because of his access to a population of chronically malnourished and vulnerable children who, as wards of the state, had little say in the quality of their diet or whether or not they participated in the study. Nor did he mention that the success of the study depended on the fact that the so-called controls and experimental subjects alike were being fed diets known to be nutritionally inadequate for anywhere between 2 and 5 years and were being actively denied certain elements of their basic dental care so as not to interfere with the experimental data being collected. In fact, the experiment that took place not far from here at the Shubenacadie Indian Residential School took these experimental methods even one step further. As was the case at other experimental schools, initial investigation showed that the students were being fed a diet lacking in the intakes of vitamins A, B complex, C, as well as iron and iodine. Investigators also noted that there was, quote, considerable increase during the winter in the number of children showing low blood levels of ascorbic acid and in the amount of gingivitis. They therefore designed a double-blind, randomized study that would compare the effect on the effect on gums and on hemoglobin of vitamin C supplements in the form of tablets. To do this, children were divided into experimental and control groups, which received 100 milligrams of ascorbic acid tablets, or placebos, daily. Some students, in other words, were given much-needed supplements, while others were denied vitamin C for the duration of the study. There is little evidence, moreover, that the other deficiencies in the children's diets were addressed in any way by Pett and the other researchers during the duration of the study. And in fact, after the conclusion of the study at Shubenacadie in 1952, Pett even went so far as to initiate plans to repeat the failed Newfoundland flour experiment at the school, even though it was found that consumption of the flour correlated with increased level of anemia at St. Mary's. Now, when I first stumbled upon the records of this and other scientific experiments conducted between 1948 and 1952 at 6 residential schools while doing my doctoral research, I was immediately taken aback. The systemic and widespread physical, sexual, and psychological abuse faced by the Aboriginal victims of Canada's Indian residential school system is well known. But when I began further research into these experiments, I was genuinely surprised when I was unable to find any additional scholarly accounts of this particularly disturbing instance of exploitation and neglect of vulnerable children at the hands of the federal government. My primary goal today is therefore a relatively straightforward one, in that I hope to simply outline these and other nutritional studies conducted in Aboriginal communities and residential schools between 1942 and 1952 in order to provide some important historical context for the experiments conducted at the Shubenacadie Residential School in particular. But in addition to simply telling the story of these experiments, I want to argue that while bureaucrats, doctors, and scientists like Pett seem to recognize the problems of hunger and malnutrition in Aboriginal communities and residential schools during this period, they also increasingly came to view Aboriginal bodies as quote-unquote experimental materials and residential schools and First Nations as kind of laboratories that they could use to pursue a number of different political and professional interests. Nutrition experts like Pett, for their part, were provided with a rare opportunity to observe the effects of both malnutrition end the use of synthetic vitamins on human subjects? Well, for bureaucrats within the Indian Affairs and Indian Health Services divisions, nutrition offered a new explanation for and possible novel solutions to the so-called Indian problem of dependency and susceptibility to disease. This convergence of professional interests led to nearly a decade of studies and experiments on Aboriginal peoples, almost undoubtedly without their informed consent or knowledge, that did little to alter the structural causes of malnutrition, and instead provide a disturbing window into the exploitative nature of Canadian settler colonialism during the middle decades of the 20th century. And while I'm going to focus much of my talk on residential schools in particular, it's important to note that these experiments did not originate in residential schools at all, but rather in Canada's north, particularly in the central subarctic, during the height of the Second World War. This period, as it turned out, was one characterized by considerable food insecurity, hunger, and malnutrition in the north, as Indigenous peoples became increasingly alienated from their traditional lands and resources in the face of a number of political, ecological, demographic, and economic changes, many of which were the outcome of a broader loss of Indigenous sovereignty over the basic means of subsistence in the north over the preceding 50 or so years. Perhaps most importantly, however, it was a period that came after more than two decades of cutbacks in government spending on emergency food relief to Indigenous peoples, as well as a complete collapse of the fur trade economy following the loss of European export markets. It was in this depressed economic context that a group of scientific and medical researchers set off on a March 1942 expedition to a number of Cree First Nations in northern Manitoba. The team included such figures as Dr. Percy Moore, the superintendent of medical services for Canada's Federal Indian Affairs Branch, and Dr. Frederick Tisdall, Canada's leading nutrition expert and the co-inventor of the infant food pablum. Almost immediately upon arriving in the communities of Norway House, Cross Lake, God's Lake Mine, Rossville, and the Paz, the research team was confronted with widespread and often readily visible signs of malnutrition. At both Norway House and Cross Lake, for instance, the team reported that, quote, while most of the people were going about trying to make a living, they were really sick enough to be in bed under treatment, and that if they were white people, they would be in bed and demanding our care and medical attention. They also found that many elderly residents were, quote, almost starved and were plainly not getting enough food to enable them to do much more than keep alive. While the leaders of the First Nations visited by the research team attributed the poor health in their communities to the recent economic crisis caused by the collapse of fur-bearing animals, fish, and game, combined with nearly a decade of cuts in relief provisions by the federal government and declining fur prices, the researchers saw things differently. They agreed that the communities visited were facing a malnutrition crisis, but they also felt that nothing could be done until they had a chance to study the problem further. As Percy Moore would tell a House of Commons Special Committee in May 1944, quote, as a result of the survey, one of the first steps considered necessary in any program to improve the health of the Indian through better nutrition was to demonstrate whether the provision of some food substances or food factors found to be lacking in their diet would result in an improvement of their health, end quote. This meant that rather than calling for immediate assistance in the form of generous relief or increased medical care to a community whose average caloric intake was under 1,500 calories per person, near starvation levels for a community whose economy depended on hunting, trapping, and fishing in an already unforgiving northern environment, Moore and the rest of the research team instead set about organizing a set of scientific experiments on the effectiveness of vitamin supplements conducted primarily by the resident physicians for the Indian Affairs Branch at Rossville, Dr. Cameron Corrigan. The study, they argued, would not only provide greater insight into the best ways of improving nutritional status of First Nations across the country for the lowest cost, but would also allow them to test their broader hypothesis that, and this is from their scientific study, quote, many characteristics such as shiftlessness, indolence, improvidence, and inertia, so long regarded as inherent hereditary traits in the Indian race, may at root be really manifestations of malnutrition, end quote. This March 1942 expedition ultimately spurred over the next decade an unprecedented series of nutritional studies in subarctic Aboriginal communities, as well as in residential schools. The first of these began in 1942 and saw 300 malnourished members of Norway House and Cross Lake First Nations, being used as experimental subjects in a study on the effectiveness of a range of different vitamin supplements in the treatment of acute nutritional deficiencies. The study saw roughly half of the group being used as controls, and the other half being provided with various kinds of supplements. This was followed by a somewhat more ambitious 1947-1948 James Bay nutrition study under the leadership of Tisdall, Moore, and University of Toronto anthropologist G. Gordon Brown. Utilizing a team of 12 researchers, including 6 physicians, a dentist, an x-ray technician, a photographer, and 3 anthropologists, the study examined the James Bay Cree communities of Attawapiskat and Rupert's House in order to explore the relationship between malnutrition, traditional indigenous foodways, and so-called dependence on government relief in 2 subarctic communities. These studies were driven by 2 interrelated hypotheses that at the hands of government bureaucrats like Percy Moore and Lionel Pett would almost become self-fulfilling prophecies. The first of these was that the already mentioned theory that nutrition might offer a promised solution to the so-called Indian problem that it's for so long preoccupied Canada's Indian Affairs bureaucrats. And closely related to this was the theory that malnutrition in Aboriginal communities was not the result of decades of failed colonial policies and systemic discrimination, but instead was the result of what they believed was inevitable transition from primitive or traditional foods to so-called modern foods. Or, as a 1948 press release from Indian Affairs argued, quote, "Canada's northern Indians have lost the art of eating. They've abandoned the native eating habits of their forefathers and adapted a semi-civilized, semi-native diet which lacks essential food values, brings them to malnutrition, and leaves them prey to tuberculosis and other disease. The white man, who unintentionally is responsible for the Indians' changed eating habits, is now trying to salvage the red man by directing him towards proper food channels." End quote. As this press release seemed to suggest, the solution to the problem of malnutrition, and therefore the so-called Indian problem more generally, was seen to be increased expert intervention into Aboriginal people's diets and everyday lives. The James Bay study, for its part, sought to assess the possibility of achieving the kinds of cultural changes deemed necessary in order to, quote-unquote, modernize Aboriginal foodways by employing a team of anthropologists whose goal was to provide insight into, quote, how the Indian ticks. As Frederick Tisdall told a parliamentary committee in 1947, "We do not know as much as we should as to what motivates the Indian. We have to find out what incentive we can place in front of him. The Indian is very different from us. We have to find out how the Indian can be encouraged, how his work can be diversified, his efforts diversified, so he can make himself self-supporting, so he can attain the food he needs." End quote. But the researchers also sought more direct, technologically focused forms of intervention into the diets of Aboriginal peoples. Moore, in particular, believed that fortified foods, combined with some sort of vitamin and mineral supplementation, could offer the best means of transforming Aboriginal diets and preventing malnutrition. This, it became clear, formed the key motivation behind the most ambitious study of all, which, under the leadership of a Federal Nutrition Division Director Lionel Pett, sought to examine the effects of expert intervention into the diets of nearly 1,000 Aboriginal students in 6 residential schools over the course of 5 years. The study was a joint effort between the Nutrition and Indian Health Services Divisions of the Federal Department of National Health and Welfare, and was spurred in part by the findings of Northern Manitoba, but also by the discovery of widespread malnutrition in residential schools following a series of visits by Red Cross and Nutrition Division dietitians between 1944 and 1947. Although Aboriginal people themselves had been arguing for decades that their children were hungry and sick because of the poor quality of food being served in schools, it was only following a series of investigations during the 1940s that government officials both in and outside of Indian Affairs began to admit that the problem of malnutrition in Canada's residential schools was systemic in nature. These initial dietary surveys of the schools were largely observational, and for the most part compared food service in schools against the official dietary requirements set up by the Federal Nutrition Division, as well as basic standards of hygiene and food safety. To this end, the investigators found almost universally poor conditions in the schools. Nearly without exception, the food provided failed to meet the government's own basic stated requirements for vitamins, minerals, protein, and in some of the most poorly operated schools, even calories. At many schools, children were not allowed second helpings, no matter how hungry they were, and so-called protective foods like meat, milk, fruits, and vegetables were a rarity. Schools often lacked trained cooking staff, and many lacked even rudimentary appliances, refrigeration, or basic sanitation. And even when there was an experienced kitchen staff, there were rarely sufficient funds to actually purchase nutritious foods. It quickly became clear to investigators that this latter issue in particular was at the heart of the problem. Based on the Nutrition Division's own calculations, the per capita grant provided for food in most schools was often half that required to maintain a balanced or nutritionally adequate diet. The sad reality is that these terrible conditions recorded by Red Cross and Nutrition Division investigators were probably not a true reflection of just how poor the food service really was in these schools. Because the inspectors let the schools know ahead of time that they were coming, it seems clear that most schools tried to paint a much rosier picture of the children's meals than was usually the case. For instance, Basil H. Johnson, a survivor of the Spanish residential school in northern Ontario, distinctly remembered the visits by nutrition inspectors, as well as the ways in which school administrators tried to alter the results in their own favor. Upon the arrival of investigators, he recalled, quote, "Instead of lard, there were pats of butter on the tin plate, and the soup was thicker than usual, with more meat and vegetables, almost like a stew." Despite attempts by some of the boys to make investigators aware that their usual menu consisted of broth, bread, lard, and tea, nothing ultimately came of the investigations, and the boys saw a return of their typical diet of, quote, "just enough food to blunt the sharp edge of hunger for 3 or 4 hours. It's also likely that the inspectors who visited the Shubenacadie Residential School saw a much rosier picture than the day-to-day reality of insufficient and often terrible quality food. As Shubenacadie survivors I spoke with today, including Iris, attested, their memories of the years at the school were of constant hunger. The experience of other survivors, included in Isabel Knockwood's haunting 1992 book, Out of the Depths, tell similar stories of constant hunger, as well as the use of food as a regular form of punishment and abuse. Whether it was the withholding of food as a form of both personal and collective punishment, or the force feeding of spoiled food to children, the memories of food were often quite traumatic. The fact that these memories are similar to those of survivors in residential schools around the country, moreover, suggests that the level of food-related abuse and neglect was systemic in nature across the country, and was clearly tied to the poor funding of schools and profound racism that guided the actions of many of the teachers and administrators that ran them. Nutrition Division Director Lionel Pett did make some early recommendations to improve the training of kitchen staff in residential schools in the aftermath of these first surveys. But after follow-up visits to some of the schools that had been visited prior to 1947 showed little or no improvement, Pett began planning for a long-term study that he argued would, quote, be designed to investigate certain questions observed, certain questions already raised regarding Indians. These included questions like, are conditions observed in northern Manitoba found elsewhere in Canada? What type of food service in residential schools will economically provide the best maintenance of health and carry over desirable food habits to a reserve? And will foods fortified with vitamins and minerals provide demonstrable results over the course of 5 years? Pett, in other words, sought to examine the effects of malnutrition firsthand, and at the same time, to also assess the adaptability of an Aboriginal diet that, according to Pett, was, quote, caught in a transition state between the fully adequate native diet and an adequate white man's diet. The solution, Pett argued, once again, was more long-term studies into the problem, with the ultimate goal being more expert intervention into the diets of Canada's Aboriginal peoples, starting in residential schools. Pett managed to gain the support of both the Department of Indian Affairs and Indian Health Services for his proposal, and in the fall of 1948 began a series of experiments that incorporated, among other things, medical and dental examinations, blood tests, like the one being shown here, intelligence and aptitude tests, as well as the collection of menus and dietary records from each of the schools. In addition to the Newfoundland flower experiment at St. Mary's School in Kenora, Ontario, and the vitamin C experiment at Shubenacadie that I discussed earlier, some of the other experiments included an examination of the effects of both inadequate and adequate milk consumption on a population of children with clinical signs of riboflavin deficiency at the Alberni School in British Columbia, an examination of the effects of something called Canada-approved vitamin B flour at the Blood School in southern Alberta, an experiment looking at the impact of a combination of intensive nutrition education and the provision of optional servings of whole wheat bread at Cecilia Jeffrey School in Kenora, and the St. Paul School in Cardston, Alberta, was chosen as a control school, meaning that no changes were made to its menus during the course of the study, despite the fact that the food served was found to be very unappetizing, and more importantly, deficient in its supply of nutrients, including iron, iodine, vitamins A, B complex, and C. While most of these studies involved at least some therapeutic value, it's important to note that none addressed the broader range of nutritional deficiencies assessed in each school. Instead, they focused on much more narrow, technologically based interventions that could be applied to the problem of malnutrition both on reserves and in residential schools alike. And in some cases, the researchers actively withheld certain treatments from students. For instance, when Dr. H.K. Brown, one of the lead researchers on the study and the chief of the Dental Health Division of the Department of Health and Welfare, discovered that Indian Health Services dentists had visited some of the students, he quickly sent off telegrams and letters insisting that for the duration of the study, quote, no specialized overall type of dental service should be provided to the students, such as the use of sodium fluoride, dental prophylaxis, or even urea compounds. Brown argued that because cavities and gingivitis were both, quote, important factors in assessing nutritional status, any significant dental interventions would impact the results of the study. Students in the experimental schools, in other words, were denied treatments that pupils in other residential schools would have already had ready access to for the duration of the five-year study. While the stated goals of these experiments were in the long term to improve the nutrition of residential schools around the country, they were also clearly designed to offer a range of possible solutions to the so-called Indian problem more generally. Alberni School Principal A.E. Caldwell, for his part, felt that the goal of the experiment was consistent with what he viewed as the goals of residential schooling. Constructive teaching in residential schools, he wrote, and I apologize for his hateful quote, will lead the Indian people away from the indolent habits inherent in the race because of their hitherto easy means of subsistence by hunting and fishing, teaching them habits consistent industry necessary to complete an industrial age, and will furthermore dispel the almost universal Indian opinion of white antagonism that makes the Indian people so difficult to negotiate with, end quote. I should add that there were spelling mistakes in, like, every fifth word. While Pett and others involved with the study saw nutrition as an alternative explanation for the so-called inherent racial traits of Aboriginal peoples, their studies were nonetheless grounded in a related set of racialized assumptions that seemed to form the starting point of all investigations of Aboriginal nutrition conducted during this period, namely that malnutrition was the cause of many of the so-called perceived racial characteristics that had typically been used to define the scope of the so-called Indian problem, and that the observed net levels of malnutrition tended to be the consequence of an inevitable transition from traditional to modern foods. The solution, unsurprisingly, was once again more expert intervention, whether through education or the kinds of nutritional technologies being tested in the six residential schools involved in the nutrition division's experiment. There is, of course, little evidence in the documentary record as to whether Pett, Tisdall, Moore, or any of the other researchers involved in the Canadian nutrition studies discussed the ethical implications of their work. While these experiments are, without a doubt, ethically dubious or even repugnant by contemporary standards, the reality was that during the 1940s, there were few written rules governing the ethics of medical research in Canada, and there was by no means a requirement that the research subjects give their informed consent to take part in a medical study. Although the very concept of informed consent was established during the period that these studies were taking place, in the form of the Nuremberg Code of Experimental Research Ethics, the practice was by no means universal. The Nuremberg Doctors' Trial, for its part, which saw infamous Nazi doctors prosecuted for horrific experiments conducted on Jewish prisoners in particular, actually received little coverage in either the American or Canadian press, and according to historian Jay Katz, even scientists who were aware of the Nuremberg Code often viewed it as, quote, a code for barbarians and not for civilized physician investigators. When interviewed in May 2000 about the fact that dental treatments were withheld from the children, Pett, for his part, distinguished between his experiment and one that would be considered unethical by arguing that it was, quote, not a deliberate attempt to leave children to develop cavities, except for a limited time or place or purpose, and only then to study the effects of vitamin C or fluoride. But regardless of whether or not the studies met the ethical standards of the time, it is clear that they did little to address the widely recognized causes of malnutrition identified in the residential schools, which always boil down to a lack of proper funding for food service, and that for many of the students taking part in the study, the regular physical examinations that went along with the experiments could be confusing, painful, and sometimes traumatic. While the voices of the children themselves are often silent in the documentary record, a series of letters sent to Pett by the pupils of the Alberni Residential School in 1952 provide some insights into their experiences. While ostensibly being sent to this by this while ostensibly being sent by the students to thank Pett and the researchers for their visits to the school, it is clear from their content and by the similar format of each letter that Pett had asked the teacher specifically to have the students provide a list of all the foods that were not available in residential school, but that the children were looking forward to eating when they got home. This, I should add, was part of a larger study that Pett was conducting concurrently with the nutrition experiments that sought to ascertain the long-term effects of the residential school experience on children's eating habits once they left the schools. The letters from the students at the Alberni School listed a broad range of both store and country foods, like you can see at the bottom here, that the students were looking forward to, and often included a number of common items like homemade bread, fish eggs, duck soup, seaweed, seagull eggs, herring, pie, cherries, and alphabet soup. In addition to these lists, most students also took the time to include other messages to the research team. These ranged from simple statements like, thank you for the medical you gave us, to the more ominous, tell the nurse I said thank you for the poke she gave me. Many of the children, for instance, complained that the nurses wrote down the wrong age on their charts and were upset that the nurses would not change them. One child who complained of having the wrong age recorded also added that, quote, she didn't understand the words that Dr. Brown was saying. I was listening very carefully, too. An even more common or troubling theme of the letters was that many children want to reassure the doctors that their tests were not painful. One child, for instance, wrote that the pokes I got didn't hurt me very much, and that I got a couple of teeth out by the dentist, but it didn't hurt very much when he pulled them out. Another student wrote, thank you for all the pricks you gave us. I hope we're all going to be healthy throughout the year and not take so many teeth out. We will all try not to get sick. The fear involved in the clinical interaction between doctors and students was perhaps best captured by a student who wrote, when the nurse pricked me, it did not hurt me at all, but a little part of it is showing yet. I hope I am okay. Perhaps tellingly, the same student's letter, which I've included here, also included a correction that appears to have been added afterwards, in which the student's thanking the doctors and nurses for what they have done to us all was changed to for what they have done for us. While many of the students thanked the researchers for, quote, coming here to help us be well and strong and healthy, it was clear by the end of the study that his benefits were disproportionately skewed to the professional interests of Pett and the other researchers. For children like those who developed anemia during the course of the study, moreover, the risk to their own health often far outweighed any possible benefits that they might have received. Ultimately, it seems that none of these experiments or studies conducted between 1942 and 1952 had much in the way of long-term positive effects on the lives of those being studied. There is little evidence, for instance, that the experiment started in northern Manitoba was ever actually finished, but even if it was, the results did not appear to have been published in a scientific journal. some of the results of the other experiments in residential schools were presented at conferences or workshops or were published in journals, usually obscure journals. But they too seem to have had little effect on the operation of food services in residential schools beyond those that took part in the study. And they also seem to have had little effect on scientific research during the period. Reports also continued to come in regarding poor food service in schools not included in the experiments. In 1953, for instance, Indian Health Services received reports from carpenters working on the Brandon Residential School in Manitoba that the children, quote, are not being fed properly to the extent that they are garbaging around in the barns for food that should only be fed to barn occupants, a situation largely confirmed by a subsequent surprise visit and inspection. In the end, it was only in 1957 that the largely inadequate per capita grant system that had governed federal funding for residential schools since 1892 was replaced by a more consistent controlled cost system. This new system gave Ottawa the power to audit schools it was funding, and for the first time, the federal government had some direct say in the quality of food being served in the institutions through a system of formal standards and inspections. Yet, as historian John Molloy has argued, this new system was far from effective and allowed the persistence of both neglect and abuse of students. Nearly a decade of experiments and studies of Aboriginal foodways and malnutrition appears to have similarly done little to alter the pre-existing assumptions held by federal policymakers and bureaucrats like Pett and Moore. Both continued to push for expert-driven, technological solutions as a means of easing the so-called transition from traditional to modern foodways. And in many ways, such attitudes simply fit within the technocratic and paternalistic ethos of Canada's administration of Aboriginal peoples during this period. The 1950s, after all, saw the Department of Northern Affairs and Natural Resources attempt to socially engineer a solution to the so-called Eskimo problem of hunger and dependency in a number of Inuit communities by experimentally relocating them without their informed consent to unfamiliar and often unforgiving new Arctic settlements. As has since been well documented, the result was not only profound social and cultural dislocation, but in the tragic case of the Aharimut of Anandai Lake, the result was also hunger, starvation, and misery. The decision to engage in such brazen attempts at social engineering, of course, came from the same mindset that drove Moore, Tisdall, and Pett to conduct their own scientific experiments. As Northern Affairs Executive Officer Robert Phillips wrote to the Deputy Minister in 1955, it was useful for the department to, quote, think of 9,000 Eskimos as a laboratory experiment and give the imagination full rein on what might be done to improve the culture. Indigenous people, in other words, continued to be seen as experimental materials, and their communities as laboratories for both scientific and social experimentation, well after the experiments of Pett, Moore, and Tisdall had ended. Perhaps the most significant legacy of these studies of Aboriginal nutrition during the 1940s and 1950s is that they provide us with a unique and disturbing window into the ways in which, under the guise of benevolent administration and even charity, bureaucrats, scientists, and a whole range of experts exploited the discovery of malnutrition in Aboriginal communities and residential schools to further their own political and professional interests, rather than to address the root causes of these problems, or for that matter, the Canadian government's complicity in them. This was made possible in large part due to the persistence of the false perception that First Nations had somehow been left behind by modernity and were therefore in need of the benevolent hand of settler scientists, experts, and professionals. As Paulette Regan, the Director of Research for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, has forcefully argued, real truth and reconciliation can only occur when settlers genuinely begin to understand and take responsibility for the legacy of systemic violence and oppression that characterized the residential school system and Indigenous settler relations in Canada more generally. These experiments, therefore, must be remembered and recognized for what they truly were. One among many examples of a larger institutionalized and ultimately dehumanizing colonialist racial ideology that has governed Canada's policies towards and treatment of Aboriginal people throughout the 20th century. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Ian Mosby's talk, Nutrition Research and Human Experimentation at the Shubenacadie Indian Residential School in Historical Context. It was an invited lecture at Acadia University and the Millbrook First Nation on September 18, 2013. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.